Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Johnny.
And the reason it took us 2 hours to get across the street, because Russ told me a story. Just in case I caught laryngitis or something, I guess he wanted me to recommend him. I'm just tickled to death to be here. I'm always very glad to be in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I've come to understand down through a period of years that it's a privilege to be in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it's even greater privilege to be asked to participate in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I've come to understand in my own life and my own experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that active participation in Alcoholics Anonymous has an awful lot to do with staying sober. I'm extremely pleased to be here tonight, fully clothed and in my right mind. And the reason I tell you that is not for any particular reason other than the fact that the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. And I never want to forget that a little over 25 years ago right now, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement at a maximum security penitentiary. And because of a loving God, as He expressed Himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around like an animal. And if I don't get anything out of that at all, I guess I could live with that all the way home. I'd like to be able to stand here tonight or anywhere else anybody would listen to me, and to be able to tell you in all sincerity, that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. God, I'd love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, they kept me alive long enough to find you. You see, I'm just as sure as I'm standing here without them working in my life, I'd have probably blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. As far back as I can ever possibly remember, I've been some type of emotional left fielder. I've always been out there wandering around somewhere with them. You know who they are, don't you? They're the reason we're in here. If somebody wandered up to you tonight and said, who was that them days he was talking about, you send them to Al-Anon. They still don't know who they are. And that's because they're they. But I used to have a lot of I didn't know it was all over that quick. I just got a little juice over here, huh, Wesley? Yeah. I had a lot of problems in my life as far back as I could ever possibly remember. I always felt like I wasn't there. They were, I wasn't. I just felt like I wasn't there. I don't know. I didn't feel like I belonged to my family. I felt like they had something that they weren't telling me, and I didn't understand what was going on, and I was terribly ashamed of them, because I lived in a little town in Kansas, and all my people were bootleggers. They made whiskey. I had aunts who did a lot of strange things, and they lived on the other side of the tracks. And we did a lot of strange things. I was very ashamed of them. That's the first thing I remember feeling, is that shame. And then right behind that came a tremendous wall of anger inside of me. And I didn't understand that for a long, long time. And I wandered around most of my life trying to figure out who was responsible for the way I felt. Because it was never my fault. It was always somebody else's fault. And I remember I had an excuse that I followed for a long, long time. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, 4 drunken uncles, 3 drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said to myself way back there somewhere, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. These are the bad people in life. I don't belong around them. I'm going to go out there and find out where I belong. So that's what I did. I remember the first place I looked, I went where my grandmother went. Now, my grandmother was a nice old lady who lived, she was 90 years old. And she never took a drink of alcohol or smoked a cigarette in her life. My grandmother prayed a great deal, and my grandmother went to church a great deal, and I had some kind of an idea that if I just went where my grandmother went, I'd be okay. Because my grandmother wasn't like these people on the outside, and I didn't feel on the inside the way these people looked, so I felt that I was like my grandmother. And so I just knew that if I went where my grandmother went and did what my grandmother did, I wouldn't feel the way I felt, and I never wanted to feel the way I felt. I never wanted to think the way I thought. I never wanted to have those kind of thoughts in my head. I don't know what I wanted, but I didn't want those because they weren't good thoughts. They were bad thoughts about people. And I didn't like that kind of stuff, and I never wanted to think that way. And I thought maybe if I could just go where my grandmother went, I wouldn't think that way. So one Sunday, a long time ago, we got up and I left these people that I felt different and strange and irritable around. We went on the other side of town and sat down in another room full of people, and I felt different and strange and irritable, and I hated all those people. I didn't understand that. And then I did something that I did most of my life up until and including coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember sitting in that church a long, long time ago. Now I'm different, I'm strange, I'm irritable, I hate everything that moves in the world. I got that tremendous hole inside of me with the wind whistling in there, and I don't know what to do about that. And I wait for this guy to mount that rostrum and those long flowing robes and tell me why I feel that way. And I remember the guy looking down where I was sitting that day and telling me I was supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. He said, you're supposed to love your brothers and your sisters. And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for a reason I didn't even understand, and God felt guilty about that. I became frightened to death sitting in that church a long, long time ago that people were going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. And I didn't know what to do about that either. I turned to walk outside the door of the church that day. My old man standing there drunk and hungover. He reached over and tapped me on the head and said, son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me. There's a lot of things in life I didn't want to be, but my old man wasn't one of them because he was a drunk. And I hated him for it. See, I lived in a house where there were two drunks working. And if you haven't lived in a nightmare like that, I'll explain it to you. In a house like that, in the middle of the night, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture and deathly silence. Every once in a while, the old man come got me and start kicking me around. He didn't do it to my brothers. He just did it to me. And I can remember laying there in the middle of the night when he's gone somewhere. And he's out there, and I know he's coming in. I know he's going to come and get me. And I'm laying there, terrified with my thoughts. And I think about things. I think about my uncles who live in those penitentiaries. And I think about my aunts who work in those houses on the other side of the tracks. I think about my old man who beats up my mother who beats up my old man. I think about all that stuff. And I'm trying to figure out what causes it all. And somewhere way back there in the middle of the night, it dawned upon me what the problem was. It's alcohol. They drink and they do those things. I'm not going to drink because I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out into that world. I'm going to have something. I'm going to do something. I'm going to be something. But what do you do if you're weird? Tell you what I did. I took a drink. Wasn't any big decision on my part. I just got into my old man's bootleg hooch and took a drink of alcohol. And it was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. It just went down in there and just kind of tore all that madness from me. That's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol took me from the black pit of nothingness. It moved me into the gray fringes of the business of living, stalled in me some type of arrogance that said, damn you, world, it's all right. Maybe I'm not good enough to be around the good people, and maybe I'm too good to be around the bad people, but it's okay right here. That's what alcohol did for me. Now, I'll tell you a strange secret. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. And the reason I don't drink alcohol or use all them other funny things anymore is because they don't work. That's as simple as I know how to tell you. Now, the sad part about my life is they quit working 10 years before I knew they did. And that's pure hell. And if you haven't lived in that type of a nightmare, I pray God you never lived there. What happened to me is I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later they pulled me out from underneath a bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. My mother took me out of that reform school and brought me to California. On the way to California, my mother said, we get to California, things are going to be different. They were. We left our one-room shack in Kansas, went to California, got us a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mother got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went out in the street corner and got drunk. I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing I'd ever found that ever did the same thing twice in succession. I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground, have somebody come along kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out that if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated it doing. It went down in there, took that madness out of me, it took me from over there and it stood me there and gave me that, and I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. I spent the next 3.5 years in a running court battle with my mother, a lawyer, and a judge. Once a month it went like this. My mother come to visit me and she said, I love you and I miss you. When you come home, things are going to be different. Once a month we went in front of a judge. He sent me to Whittier State Reform School. Once a month my mother stood up with a lawyer and appealed. Now for a long, long time I didn't buy all that because I'm already building those walls around me. I'm not letting anybody in. But somewhere during that 3.5 year period of time, I switched over and started to believe my mother. And the reason I started to believe my mother is because I wanted so desperately to believe my mother. I wanted so desperately to believe that the answer to my problem was in a little white house with a little picket fence with a little old lady with a tray full of cookies and milk. Now, the reason I wanted to think about that all my life was, if that's true, I can do anything I want to do to anybody I want to do it to them to for as long as I want to do it and show up someday and eat cookies and be wonderful. That's the way I thought all my life. Now, I didn't know that when I was doing it. That's just the way I thought. One day we went in front of that judge, and I guess he was getting tired of my mother and her lawyer. So he made a deal with my mother, and they put me in a boys' home in San Fernando Valley. When I got there, the superintendent told me if I was a good kid, I could go home on a home trip in 30 days, and God, I was good. 30 days came and went. They loaded us on an old truck, and they brought us out of the valley, and it was an all-day trip. They dropped us off in downtown Hollywood, and I had to run to catch the old subway car to ride down to Los Angeles. Had to get off of that and run down to 6th and Main to catch the old red car to ride out to Willowbrook where I lived. And on the ground, a mile and a half to my mother's house. It's all over now. No more different, Sam. No more apart from. I'm going to be all right. I got to my mother's house. There was a drunken party going on there. Nothing had changed except me. I'd spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I'd heard a lot of strange things. I'd heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody you care for them, they used to tell me, because that's weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter, because the minute you do that, they come along and kick you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe that, because there was something way down deep inside of me said, no, that's not true. But I walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself, if I lived to be 500 years old, I'd never show anybody any human emotions again. And I went on the street corner and got drunk. I come home next month and got drunk again. Long about that time in my life, I was a periodic. Well, I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. It was always the same thing. I'd come home and throw a brick through the window and get a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and get drunk and go back to school. And my first week in school was fine. I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. My second week in school was fine. I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. My third week in school, the madness hit, and I started to think. I started to think about showing up in the neighborhood. I started thinking about walking up to my gang. My gang wanted me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what my gang would say about telling them I didn't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an architect, or an engineer. What would my gang would say? What would my gang would say about telling them I didn't want to go out and hit people in the head. I wanted to go play baseball. I wonder what they would say. But you see, if you're like me and you're nothing, and you're glued over there against the corner of the wall, you're trying to figure out that magic thing that frees you from there and stands you there and gives you that. You think about that. And finally the answer comes, it's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. So you just think about that for a while. Think about capping a seal on that baby and pouring it down and make that magic come all about you. One day I sit out on the street corner with a gallon of wine. I opened up the seal and drank the whole gallon. I'm sober as I am right now. Frightened to death because my magic wasn't magic anymore. I didn't know what to do about that. Guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try these? And he gave me some pills. I found out that if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. Wasn't very much longer after that, sitting on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine, nothing was working. And the guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try this? And he gave me some morphine. I found out if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of things that sustained me for the next 14 years of my life. It was never one or two, it was a combination of all of them. I became too old to stay in that school, so I came out in my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition in life. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. But I had a problem. I didn't stand up too often. That's really not conducive for being a gangster. You have to look alert when you're out there doing anything. You can't run in and say, stick them up and puke on somebody. It really doesn't have a ring of machoism about it. Now, I don't know what they do in Miami, but where I live, you don't gather up in the neighborhood and talk about puking. You gather up in the neighborhood and talk about being tough. And the reason you gather up and talk about being tough It's because you're scared to death. Somebody's going to find out you're scared to death. And when you're as frightened as I was, and you never quite belong wherever you are anyhow, and you don't ever quite measure up to whatever you have to measure up to, you've got to do an awful lot of things just to almost fit there. And what I did, I had to be worse than everybody else. So I took all of my fear and I turned it into hostility and violence. I knew it was much easier to run and smack somebody before they found out how scared I was. And if you're like me and you live out in the streets, you go to jail a great deal, because I lived in the streets. That's what I did. The only time I was living in the streets, I was locked up somewhere. I was a street person. And when you're out there, you got to do an awful lot of things just to survive. You see, I became willing, from my first drink to my last, to pay any penalty that there was to pay, to go to any length that I had to go to, just to get that feeling that I got the day I took my first drink. And you know what a sad dilemma that was in my life? I spent 20 years of my life trying to recapture that first feeling that happened to me when that magic hit my inside. And it never quite ever did it again. And I just switched from things to things to things to things, trying to get that thing going on. So alcohol to me became the great deceptor of life. And I became willing. And when you live like that, you go to jail a great deal because you're out there. And they come and get you and just throw you in a car and you go to jail with them. You don't ask them, what do you want? They say, get in. You just get in. Because if you hadn't done anything that day, you did something yesterday. Or you were getting ready to do something tomorrow. And there was no argument with them. This was a long time ago, before we were sensitive. I was down the other day talking to an old man that I love very much, and I was telling him about my life. And he says, in all those years you were doing all that time being locked up, did they treat you for alcoholism? And I said, no, they were treating me for criminalism. There was a difference. Alcoholism wasn't recognized in those days. You just went to jail, I guess. I don't know. I've always figured I was 20 years ahead of my time anyhow. I used to figure, God, if they would only legalize dope, I'd have it made. God, now they've legalized dope, I don't need it anymore. Isn't that amazing? It's really amazing how I just kind of end up in those kind of things. I got arrested once and sentenced to the United States Army. Now, I wanted to go to jail, but my mother wanted me to go in the Army. She didn't want me to put a mark on the family's good name or something. I don't know what she had in her mind. I had the slightest idea what Mom thought about. You know, Mom's still drinking, so I still don't know what she's thinking about. But anyhow, they put me in the Army. Now, my Army career is very brief, because I'm not eligible for the GI Bill of Rights. I wasn't there most of the time. And when I was there, it was under duress or arrest or something like that. That's the way it was in my Army career. I had it all backwards. If they told me to stand up, I sit down. If they told me to go over this way, I went over that way. If they told me I couldn't go somewhere, I went anyhow. And that's really not conducive for being in the Army. They don't kind of like that kind of behavior. It's almost like being a weird person and them not knowing about it or something. But anyhow, I came out of there, and I guess in the latter part of the 40s, 48, 49, and 50, I rode the crest of what society calls a crest. I had a long time thinking about that in the Army. I came to the idea that lack of power was my dilemma, and I got caught up in that idea that power came in a money clip. And I figured when I came out of the Army, if I could accumulate enough power, they couldn't bother me, so I accumulated a lot of power. I got everything that society says is powerful. I got a big apartment building. I moved into the top floor. I got me a closet full of $300 suits. I parked a big automobile in the garage. And people came around at all hours of the night and day, and they begged the big man for favors. Every once in a while, the big man would grant him a favor. The only problem was that the big man couldn't leave his apartment, because every time they did, they jumped on him and took him to jail. But I used to feel brave every once in a while. I'd sneak down the back stairs about 5 o'clock in the afternoon when the traffic's heavy. I got on one of my new suits and I get my big automobile and I drive around this little neighborhood that I lived in. And I got nobody around to impress about what a big man I am, and I'm not too impressed with me anyhow. And I'm driving up alongside of people in no big pickup trucks, and I'm asking them little questions like, I wonder what's the matter with me? Wonder why I can't be like him? I wonder why I can't be like my brother? I wonder why I can't just have a wife and a couple of kids and a job like everybody else. I wonder what's the matter with me. You see, I had no way of knowing at that time that I'm slowly but surely running out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions. And the thing that kept me from going totally and permanently insane was my ability to blame somebody other than me for my own actions. And when I run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions, I had one left. It's God's fault. He don't like me. The God my grandmother talked about who punished little boys who were bad. You know, I can hear that in AA every once in a while if I listen real careful. I guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot it down here to the club. Deal. I tell you how I feel about that. Next time you get hungry, you go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. God squirts you one through the keyhole, you call me. I'll be on the next plane to Miami. They told me when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I want me a garden, I better get me a hoe. I've lived sober enough in Alcoholics Anonymous, long enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to erase all the excuses in my life for my actions, except for me. I am responsible for my actions, always have been, always will be, until the day I die, and alcohol and drugs had no part in it whatsoever. They just made it bearable for me to live that way. That's all. I can't even blame alcohol and drugs for the things I did, because I've done a lot of things that I used to do, almost, while sober. So I don't blame alcohol and drugs for my behavior. I can't even blame God for it. 1951, I'm on my way to the penitentiary for the first time, and the bottom is starting to come up real quick now. My mother come to visit me, and she screamed at me through the visiting screen that I was a murderer. It seemed that my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison and taken an overdose of it and died. I didn't know how to handle that. I handled like I handled most things. I got mad at it, made it go away. 2 days later, they handcuffed me between two detectives, and they stood me out underneath a tree, and they buried my baby brother. Now, I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging around my shoulders, and I want to cry, and I don't know how. I don't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth. The reason I don't have them is because I don't think they're necessary. I went on to the penitentiary. I stayed there a little over 4.5 years. I came out of there a little 4.5 years sicker than I was when I went in there. I spent the next couple of years of my life trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He said, "Johnny, people like you don't change." He says, "You're doomed to die in an institution." He took me down and showed me a little green room. He says, "You're going to end up here, hotshot." I told him, "Not me. I'm different. How come I'm off now that institution, bound determined I had that deal beat, and 6 months later I'm laying in a nut house, kicking and screaming?" And that's when I made my round to some of the better laughing academies in the country, interviewing psychiatrists. I used to talk to doctors. I'd sit there with my wraparound overcoat on and talk to them. They talked to me about my mother, and I talked to them about their mother, and they threw me out of the room. And then they introduced me to a thing called better living through electricity. That kind of gets your attention. That was before Thorazine was popular. It kind of got you there quicker, you know what I mean? Just, you're gone for a while. I was talking at a meeting not long ago, and some little gal walked up to me after the meeting, and, you know, I said something about that before Thorazine, and she wandered up to me after the meeting. She's one of the type of people that the lights were on, but nobody was home, you know what I mean? And she said, "You know what?" And I said, "What?" And she says, "You know, I took Thorazine and shock treatments, too." I said, "Wow." I said, "What does that do for you, honey?" She said, "Nothing. You just take about a half a step a week." If you ain't been there, you wouldn't know it yet. I remember my last session with Skull Jockeys. It was in a nut factory in Fort Worth, Texas. The reason I know it was a nut factory because I was there. Wherever I was a nut house. Believe me, they could have put any name they wanted to put on it. It was a nut house because I was there and I was nuts. You see, when I was locked up, I was nuts. When I wasn't locked up, I was loaded. There's a vast difference. When I was locked up, I just thought about getting out and getting loaded. When I was loaded, all I thought about was getting the money to get loaded on. And I was in this nut factory, and they just reduced me to a state of childishness one more time. And they shuffled me in and sent me down behind this big desk. I remember this very clearly because I looked up on the wall of that big desk and I saw all those diplomas and plaques hanging up there. And I thought to myself, maybe he knows. Nobody else ever did. Maybe he does. And I remember this guy sitting there, and I want you to understand, I felt exactly, sitting at that man's desk, exactly the same way I felt sitting at my grandmother's knee when I was a kid in church. I'm still different. I'm still strange. I'm still irritable. I hate everything that moves in the world. I got that tremendous hole inside of me that doesn't seem to plug up anymore. And now I've got one more problem that's worse than all the rest of those problems put together. Now the things that I put in my system to make those other problems go away, no longer make them go away. Now I'm in trouble. Now I can't get rid of me at all. Now I can't turn off the nightmares. Now I can't get rid of the faces of the people I've harmed. Now I can't do any of that stuff. I'm in a lot of trouble. And you know what the doctor said to me that day? Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problem. As sick as I was, I knew that wasn't a problem. See, my problem was I was nothing. I've always been nothing. I came from nothing. I was nothing. I was going to be nothing. I used to put something in me. I became almost. To a nothing, almost is top of the world. Here's a guy who's supposed to know, who obviously does not know, that the thing I put in my system is not the problem. The problem is I'm a nothing. He's trying to tell me that the thing that transfers me from a nothing to an almost is a problem, when I know the problem is I'm a nothing. Like trying to tell the guy when the building fell down, the elevator was defective. Didn't make any sense to me. You know what being treated by the state of California and the federal government for 20 years of my life proved to me? How unique I was. That there wasn't anybody else upon the face of the earth like me. On a Greyhound bus coming back from Fort Worth, Texas to L.A. to die, I just knew that. I knew that I'd come from another planet somewhere and they weren't coming back to get me. Because nobody knew and nobody cared. And that's the way it was, and I was going to have to live this way till God only knows when, and nothing I could do could change that. And a little over 26 years ago, they captured me again, and they laid me down in the bed in the old Los Angeles County Jail. I weighed 128 pounds, and I was yellow. They tied my left arm and my right leg down. The medical doctor stood at the foot of my bed and told me he was going to die. He said, "Son, you're going to die, and there's nothing we can do for you." And I said, "Okay." All day passed and all night passed. He came back in my room the next morning. He stood there and said the same thing. "Son, you're going to die, and there's nothing I can do for you." And I said, "Okay." The third day he came into my room, I had a terror grip me that I've never known before since in my entire lifetime. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again, and God knows I didn't want to do that. I laid in that bed for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I'd ever said in my life. I said, "Oh God, help me." Now, I thought for a long, long time that nothing had happened. Because there was no blinding flashes of light, nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, "We got an A meeting down there." Little bird didn't come in and drop the fifth chapter on my chest. I didn't wander off into the tulip somewhere. I just went to sleep for a little while. And I don't know how many of you ever kicked a two-year heroin habit, but that's what I was doing. And that's the first time I've been asleep in a long time. Show you how crazy I was, and show you how insane I was. 2 weeks after I'd heard that prayer in my deathbed, I'm up running around the jail looking for some more of the poison to put me back on the bed I'd just gotten off of. I didn't know any better. I'm still looking for the answer in the end of a bottle or end of a hypodermic syringe. I'm looking for the answer somewhere where it wasn't, out there somewhere, in something, people, places, or thing, or circumstance, or condition to make me feel better in here. A little while later, I'm standing in front of a Superior Court judge being sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. It doesn't mean anything to me at all. That's the way I live. Turn to walk out of the courtroom that day, changes conversation from me to a lady sitting in the courtroom. And what he said to her was the most damning piece of evidence anybody ever presented about me in my life. He said to her, "Lady, if you care anything at all about the child you carry inside of you, you'll get so far away from this scum, you'll never be allowed to lay eyes on it. He's a blood-sucking parasite in society. He has no right being around decent people. If it was in my power, he's never going to be." And I'm walking out of the courtroom saying, "He's not talking about me. That must be my old man or my uncles or my grandfather or somebody." But he was talking about me.
This is the end of side one. Please do not use your fast forward or reverse. You stop, turn to side two. Your cassette will then be in proper position.
time trying to hide from the world what I really, really was in here. Not what I put up out there, but what I was in there. That's the thing that drove me crazy. I tell you how small my world was and how so obsessed I was with myself at that time. I thought that everybody who lived upon the face of this earth was in that courtroom, that everybody knows now. So I ran off and hid in solitary confinement for the next 9 months of my life. And that's the way I was when I stumbled into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the first Sunday in November, 1959. I wandered into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, nor do I take any credit for staying here from that day to this day, because if I'd have known where I was coming, I wouldn't even have come. The reason I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is because the institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 24 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around here ever since. You gotta be careful what gets us sick people in here. I remember my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved in and sat down in the back row in what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have froze to death, for God's sake. I remember looking up on the backboard. I saw two big A's, and I thought to myself, my God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I said to this clown sitting next to me, what is this? He says, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous or Over Hip Anonymous or Dope Fiends Anonymous or something that little ring of class about it, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what one was, but I didn't want to be one. So I thought to myself, self, I think I'll sit around and wait for these women to get up and tell their racy stories. And they got up and threw me a curve. Because they had sort of a twinkle in her eye and sort of a smile on her face. They sort of radiated something I didn't understand. Right away they run it to start talking about God. When I came here and you talked to me about God, I got up and ran out of the room because God was the reason I was. It was not my fault. It's God's fault. But I kept coming back to your meetings because I'd seen you. And seeing you, I'd seen the miracle, and I didn't know that either. I kept coming back. You kept talking about God, I kept leaving. Every once in a while, I'd think about you. I'd wander around that institution, I'd think about you. One time, I grabbed one of them convicts and threw him up against the wall, looked in his eyes, said, you don't have it, and turned around and walked off. You get a lot of strange comments in those places when you start doing stuff like that. Well, I thought I was a little weird anyhow. You know, one Sunday morning a long, long time ago, I got up and went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I had no way of knowing that's the day I'd lived my entire lifetime for. No way of knowing that. If I'd have known it, I probably wouldn't have went to an AA meeting. I went over and I sat down in the back row of this meeting where I always sat. I don't remember my attitude being any different. I don't remember my hostility being any less. I don't remember my Arab differences being any lesser that day. I don't remember anything about it at all. I remember the little guy that I knew did 23-5 years in the penitentiary, stood at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and told me something I've never forgotten. It made more sense to me than anything I'd ever heard. It makes more sense to me right now than anything that I know. He looked down where I was sitting and telling me I didn't have to live that way anymore. He says, you don't have to do it like this no more. You know, nobody'd ever told me that. They've been telling me all my life, don't drink, swallow, smoke, and shoot. But they didn't tell me how to live without doing it. After the meeting, I went up to him. I said, how do you learn how to live? He looked at me and he smiled. He said, Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. You go get that book. I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it. I guess that little fella prayed real hard. I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I've ever found in this book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all society's ills. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. Now I'm going to tell you about the strange phenomena that take place in my life, and my life is the only thing I know anything about. It seemed like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in this book, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. Now, I had a lot of trouble when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was different. I just wasn't like you. I was different. I prided myself in my differences. And the more prideful I became in my differences, the sicker I became. And the sicker I became, the more prideful I became. And the more prideful I became, the more different I became. And I sit at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and look for the differences and hear all the things I could hear and pick out that made me different and separated me from you. And I'd hear things like, I used to drink. Now I don't drink anymore and everything is wonderful. I'd say, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. I'm not drinking either and I'm crazier than a loon. I didn't understand that. But you see, I was different. Didn't understand it. I just didn't understand it. I heard a guy one time say, you got to get active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what active was. A couple of days later, I went up to this secretary in the yard, and I didn't want anybody seeing me talking to that AA secretary. So I, heaven forbid anybody see me get well. I mean, I had a reputation. I was crazy. Kind of liked that reputation. Besides, you don't want any of the guys in there to see you get well. Heaven forbid you may not be able to come back and live with them anymore. So I said to this clown, I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, you got to get active. He said, that's right. I said, I'd like to know what I could do in Alcoholics Anonymous so nobody know I'm a member. He said, what? I said, I want to know what I can do in AA so nobody know I'm a member. He says, you really are sick, aren't you? I was dead serious. Now, I don't know what I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I really don't. I don't know what I wanted when I was early, and I guess I wanted what you have. I didn't know what you had. I didn't know. And sobriety wasn't attractive to me. I was sober. I just didn't like me when I was sober. I didn't like you, me, or anybody when I was sober. I didn't like you when I was drunk either. I liked you even less when I was sober. I don't know what I wanted. I guess I wanted what you had, only I didn't know what you had. I guess. You see, what I wanted whatever it was you had that I didn't know what you had. And I want to live my own lifestyle. See, I want to be hip, slick, keen, and cool. See, I want to be a big-time convict and a big-time dope fiend. I want to be a big-time you-know-what and sober, too. Do you know what will happen to you if you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous for 24 years and some odd months? Try to the best of your ability to practice these principles one day at a time and give this program to anybody who wants. You know what will happen to you? This program will de-hip you. Absolutely will. You know how come I know that? Not very long ago, my 21-year-old daughter called me a square. She said, Daddy, you're a lame. I said, thank God I've made it. I damn near died out there hip. I almost died here hip. I was almost too hip to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. You watch them, the hip ones, they just bounce right out the door. See, my problem when I came to Alcoholics, I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I wasn't one. And I would admit to being. I couldn't get the word up. It stuck right there. So I was a convict. Then I became a convict and a drug addict. Then I became a convict and a drug addict and a weirdo. Then I became a convict and a drug addict and a weirdo and a young person. And then just so you wouldn't let me out, I became an alcoholic. You know what my enders were? My enders were doorways that would allow me to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all. They were my little differences. Well, you may have to work those steps, but you're an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic ender. I don't have to do nothing but not drink. You know what I am today? I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what that means to you, but I can tell you what it means to me. You see, if I'm an alcoholic and you're an alcoholic and you have to do something to stay sober, so do I. But by the same token, if I'm an alcoholic and you're an alcoholic and I have to do something to stay sober, so do you. And the reason I know that is because the 100 people who wrote this book called Alcoholics Anonymous were alcoholics. These people were alcoholics and they told me that as a result of doing certain things happened to them. But you see, when I came here, I was different. I wasn't like you. You kept talking about this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept telling you I was different. And I got tired of hearing about this book. So I was going to show you once and for all that I was different. This thing wouldn't work for me. I was going to do what it says to do in this book to prove to you I was different. I couldn't admit that. I couldn't get the word alcoholic. It stuck here. I couldn't even admit that my life was unmanageable. I'd been a ward of the state of California for 20 years. I was doing a real good job with my life. It says that here I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself, which there wasn't, could restore me to something that I wasn't. I got papers to prove I'm nuts by some of the best doctors who've ever dwelt in that field. I could admit that. It says I had to make a decision, which I wasn't capable of, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. I didn't understand Him. I didn't want no part of Him, no how, no place. Look what He'd done to me. But you know, they told me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that this book is like a great big old toolbox. There's a wrench in it to fit every nut that walks in the door. And there was one that got me. Now, I didn't do these things with any type of a noble expression. I didn't do these things for sobriety because I was sober. I did these things to prove to you I was different. It wouldn't work for me. So I had to sit down with a tablet and a pencil and write out a searching and a fearless moral inventory of myself. Not of you, but of me. And the only reason I did it was to prove to you I was different. It wouldn't work for me. And to go on further and prove to you I was different, it wouldn't work for me, I sat down with a man that spent 3.5 hours telling about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. And somewhere during that 3.5 hour period of time, I heard myself say something to that man. It started way down here and it worked all the way up. I heard myself saying to that man I was an alcoholic. And with the utterance of that word from way down in my innermost self to this very instant, there'd been a freedom inside of me that it's hard for me to describe if you've never felt it. If you've never had that freedom come over you as a result of doing these things, you'll never understand what I'm talking about. Never in a thousand years. Because it ain't anything that you can talk about. If you haven't experienced it, you'll never know what it's like to have a complete and total healing of your soul almost in an instant. You see, I understood at that time when I heard myself saying alcoholic, I knew what an alcoholic was. Because I'd read in the book Alcoholics Anonymous what the disease of alcoholism is. I found out in the fourth and fifth step I had this disease. I also found out by reading this book that if I don't do something about this disease, if I don't discern this disease and its cure over to a power greater than myself, I found out that if I don't do that, I'm going to die or go nuts. I was already nuts. I just didn't want to die. And I found out that through a fourth and fifth step, that I had a God of my very own. That He was within me and had always been within me, and from that day to this day, I have never been by myself anymore. I have never been apart from. I have been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous from the day I attempted to work these principles of recovery. So no matter where I'm at, whether it's in Miami Beach or Bellflower at the Big Book Group, I'm a member of Alcoholics. I feel just as much at home here as I do there. Didn't make any difference to me. I've had all kinds of people come into my life and help me from the time I attempted to work these principles in my life. People had no business being in my life. Had no business saying the things they said to me. Had no business doing the things for me they said. No business whatsoever. And they weren't all alcoholics. Three of the greatest men who ever lived in my life were a guy who owned a little restaurant in this little town of Tehachapi where this penitentiary was. A little guy that owned a dental lab and a little dentist. Three of the greatest people who ever lived in this life gave me one of the greatest gifts of love that I've ever understood in my life. You see, along about this time in my life, my vocabulary consisted of about four-letter words. Mother ran all around in there somewhere. It's kind of the trigger that made everything go. And I'm sitting there cutting this little dentist's hair one day, and he's talking to me, and I'm cussing him. And he said, Johnny, if you ever get out of here, what are you going to do? I told him. He says, you'll never make it. I said, why not? He says, the minute you open your mouth, they're going to know where you come from. I said, what's the matter with my mouth? He says, nothing. You just open it every now and then. And then he said to me, he asked me if I knew what cussing was. And I said, no, what is it? He said, it's a crutch for conversational cripples. And I heard myself say to this little man, well, what am I supposed to do about this? I've talked this way all my life. I don't know any way to talk. He said, if you're serious, I've got a couple of friends who will help you. So on a Tuesday night for a long period of time, this little dentist and two of his little friends set me in a room in his penitentiary, and they word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, fed me the English language. They didn't laugh and tee-hee-hee and think I was cute when I sprouted out one of those four-letter words. They looked me square in the eyes and said, "We don't say it that way, Johnny. We say it this way." And then they stood my wrath when I rained on them. And I rained on them. I didn't like to be corrected. And when they got all through with my insanity, they sent me down and we started all over again. Over and over and over again. One of my greatest blessings is that. People took time out of their lives, but this wasn't until after I had attempted to try to fulfill the conditions of this program of recovery in my life. A little over 23 years ago, they let me out of the penitentiary. Well, it'll be 23 years ago come the 4th of June this year. I come wandering out of that penitentiary. I went home to see my mother. She fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch, said, "Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting." She said, "Fine, I think you should." Took my mother a long time to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very proud, and I tell you, when she's sober, she goes to meetings. And she don't stay sober all the time, my little mother. But that isn't any of my business. I learned the greatest lesson in life from my little mother. I learned I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. Where would I get any power? I'm powerless. My book, Alcoholics Anonymous, tells me I'm powerless. It tells me, my book, it says that what I've got, period, is a daily reprieve from this thing called alcoholism. A daily reprieve. Right now, today, this is what I got. Today, I got this reprieve. And you know what? That is contingent upon my maintenance of certain spiritual conditions. That's all. Now, I have no way of knowing what spiritual conditions mean to you. I can tell you what they mean to me. They mean I can't do anything you can't watch. It's almost like having a pet parrot and giving it to the town gossip and not worrying. I'd like to tell you I live that way. I'd love to be able to tell you that. And if you believe that, I'm going to sell you this building right after the meeting's over. You know they only made one perfect person? In the whole history of time, they made one perfect man. You know what they did with him? They hung him on a piece of wood. You know why? Because he scared them. Perfect. Now see, I don't know about you. I can't love perfection. Perfection frightens me. I don't know what to do with it. I'm in awe about it. And from time to time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've held people up as perfection. Now there's an old man in California who's like my father. He's very sick, this old man, and I guess I love him as much as I'm capable of loving any human being who lives upon the face of this earth, because he probably installed more in me than anybody I've ever known. And I used to go a lot of places with him when I'm new sober out of this penitentiary. He drove a big old automobile. He went to a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and he took me with him. And I'd sit over in the corner of the car and look at him and just nod. I was scared to get near him because he was my idea of perfection. I had him so perfect, so high, sitting on his pedestal so high that he frightened me to death. I couldn't love him. I was scared of him. I was in awe of him. You can't love anything in general. I'm in awe of this great man. One day we came out of a restaurant in Santa Barbara where we stopped to get something to eat on the way back from a meeting. He reached into his glove compartment, took out two Rolaids and swallowed them. I said to myself, "Thank God he's got gas." I love that old man today. And I don't love him because of his perfection. I don't love him for his high standing, people. I love him because of his imperfection. It's been my great pleasure in the last couple of years to sit with my daddy in AA and watch him. Watch him with his fears and his doubts. And love him till I can't see straight. Not while he's perfect. Not while he's talking and doing all the things that made him perfect. But to see him as a human being. And to love him. The more human I see him, the more I love him. I spent all day Wednesday with him. And I just sit there and held his hand and told him how much I loved him. Okay. Not because he was wonderful. But you know, that shouldn't be amazing to members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me a long time to understand that. It should not be amazing to you and I how I can love something that's imperfect and why I can't. You see, I love you. And I don't love you because you're perfect. I love you because you're alcoholic. That's all. And you have that same little weakness of characters and flaws in it that I have within me. That's why I love the people who wrote this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Because all through the first 165 pages of this book, they talked about me, these people. In explaining themselves, they talked about me. And I found out that they were like me. They had weaknesses. They had character defects. They had all the things that I have while sober. And it made me love them beyond description of my love for them. See, I had trouble when I first, before I ever came here, I had those people who sat in high places, doing high things. These perfect people talking to this imperfect person, talking about all the things he should do that didn't make sense to him. And I came here, you didn't sit in high places and talk to an imperfect person. You were an imperfect person talking to an imperfect person, telling him what you did to live the way you live. And the most amazing thing about that to me is that you were so attractive in what you did. And the way you live was so attractive to me that I would have died and went to hell just to spend a moment in your presence. And I feel that way today. I would do anything just to be with you. I would go any length just to be here with you. And it don't have to be in Miami Beach. It could be in Bellflower on Monday night. It could be in Long Beach on Tuesday night. It could be anywhere that you are. That's where I want to be. Didn't got anything to do with, you know, that little girl I was never supposed to see, that judge told me I was never supposed to see. She'd given me three of the prettiest grandsons you've ever seen. Three of them. But my oldest grandson, little Jim, was just a little tyke. When he was just barely running, Karen brought him by the house, let me take care of him because she was going to a high school reunion. And Dottie had something to do that night, some meeting, so I told her I'll take care of him. She says, you think you can? I said, sure, it took care of you, didn't it? She said, not necessarily. They don't ever forget. And so I got this little fella, and you know, I do what all good grandpas do. I chased him till I couldn't chase him anymore. Then I got up in bed and turned the television set on. He chased the dogs till they couldn't be chased anymore, and they jumped up in bed and started watching television. And then he laid down and kicked himself to sleep. And I went over there and looked at him, picked him up, and put him up here, put my arms around him. And while I'm carrying my little grandson, Jim, back to my bed, I hear things in my ear. Lady, if you care anything at all about the child you carry inside of you, you'll get so far away from this scum, he'll never be allowed to lay eyes on him. He's a blood-sucking parasite in society, had no right being around decent people. And by the time I get to my bed and lie down with my grandson, I'm weeping like a baby. Uncontrollably, my daughter comes in and I'm laying there crying, and she just picks her son up, gives me a kiss on the forehead, and drives off. You know, my kids don't think anything at all about me crying when they come see me. I'll be sitting in front of a television set crying like a baby for some dumb thing on television. You see, if you don't know about that, if you don't know what it's like to sit back somewhere and be so tore up inside that you'd give anything to be able to cry, and to one day have the dam break and be able to cry at a silly thing like a television set. And I don't cry from sorrow. I cry from great joy. Because my life really is a joyous occasion. Guys like me are supposed to live the way I live. Everything that I have, everything that I ever hope to be, I owe to this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. Before you, there was nothing. Nothing before you. If you had never came into my life, there could have never been anything. See, I was a dead person looking for a place to lay down. I was waiting for somebody to throw that door closed and never let me out there for the rest of my natural life. Before you came walking into my life. And you know the strange thing about it is, I didn't ask for you to come into my life. I didn't ask for anything at all. All I did in a deathbed a little over 26 years ago, asked this God that I didn't understand to help me, God I'd never cried out to in my entire lifetime. And as a result of, somebody delivered you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was in. And because of your example, you told me about the thing that saved my life. The thing that made me what I am today is a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Within the confines of the first 165 pages of this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, I have discovered everything that is necessary in my life. My God, as I understand him today, is the byproduct of the 12 steps working in my life. Happiness, as I understand it, is the byproduct of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My willingness to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest joy that I know of. See, I don't ever want to do anything else but to be here with you. And I don't think that I love you so much just because of what you are. I like me a whole lot better when I'm near you. That's all. Sometimes I don't like me too well when I'm out there with them. Is it because I still don't quite fit out there? I still am quite a lot of times uneasy with those people out there. See, I don't know how you are. I feel kind of funny around them and standoffish. And my book, Alcoholics Anonymous, answered that to me. It said I had the idea or the delusion that I may ever be like other people has to be smashed. See, I'm an alcoholic. That doesn't mean I can't do what they do. I have more fun than 95% of the people I know of. I live better than anybody that I know of. I wouldn't trade places with anybody who walked upon the face of this earth. Nobody. It's amazing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody that knows me knows I love to play golf. About the only end I got left in my life is I'm an end golfer. I know that's a sickness all on its own, but I will play golf at the drop of a hat, I'll tell you that. And a little company I work for bought me a membership in a country club a few years ago. And on Wednesdays, I'm out there playing golf with some doctors. And I'm walking down the fairway. And on my arms, I got things like daggers through skulls with blood dripping from them. Little panthers with their sides shot out. Just dots and crosses. They're just real conversation pieces in the coffee shops. You walk up to some of them pros, they'll always give you a little look. Wonder where he was. You know. The little doctor said to me as we're walking down the fairway, "Gee, you have big forearms, Johnny." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Did you ever play baseball?" I said, "Every time I went to jail." He said, "Oh, you've never been in jail." Well, I never told him any different because that's never been my thing. I used to be bad, now I'm wonderful. I just never have been that sick, I don't think. And I'm kind of glad. Because this little friend of mine, this little doctor friend of mine, is a good friend of mine today, and over a period of years, he's told me his story. You see, he was a little Jewish orphan in the Bronx. He worked and he studied and he sacrificed. He did without, he took himself out of that orphanage. Then he worked and he studied and he sacrificed and he did without and he put himself through school. Then he saved his money and he sacrificed and he did without and he put himself through medical school and became a doctor. Then he worked and he studied and he sacrificed and he did without and he joined the country club and he plays golf on Wednesdays. That's his deal. I have no way of telling that little man. He wouldn't believe me anyhow. That I lived my entire lifetime out there on the streets. I used and abused people. I run in and out of nut houses and penitentiary all my life. And I got sober and ended up in the same place he did. And you know why I can't tell him? Because he wouldn't believe me. You see, he lives by that rule out there. That you got to work and study and sacrifice and the strong man survive and the weak man perishes and go, gee. That's the way they live. See? When I first got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I questioned people about my sobriety. I said, "What is this thing called sobriety? This is a gift from God. I want you to know I didn't want to owe God anything when I came here. So I wanted to ask these people who knew all these things what I was supposed to do for God. And they told me that my sobriety was a gift from God and what I did with my sobriety would be my gift back to God. See, my sobriety is the most priceless thing that I possess. I don't do anything to put it in jeopardy. I live no way contrary to teaching. I treasure above all things just my most priceless gift. If what I did with my gift would be my gift back to my loving Father God, I would only live with one thought and one thought only for as long as I live. I would only pray that my loving Father God would be as pleased with my gift to Him today as I've been with His for 24 years. Thank you."